This week, the Congressional Budget Office released its score for the American Health Care Act. 24 million people are expected to lose health care coverage over the next 10 years. This for an industry dedicated to providing health care and innovative treatments for patients is nothing short of a disaster. Welcome to the Event of Health podcast. My name is Jeff Stewart. We'll be talking this week by phone with Nicole Hamilton and Meg Alexander about what the American Healthcare Act means for pharmaceutical companies. Nicole, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And could you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Nicole Hamilton. I am a director for Inventive Health Consulting. I live in San Francisco, and I work out of our pricing and market access practice.
That sounds really, really boring.
It's the worst thing to talk about in a cocktail party when somebody asks you what you do. The best answer to give them is, I help pharma companies price drugs.
So the American Healthcare Act, what do you think?
What do I think? It's an interesting bill. I think one of the big takeaways for pharma is that if this bill gets through in its current form or in a form that resembles the current form, that the number of uninsured people in the United States is going to rise. And not only will the number of people who are uninsured rise, but those that are covered, particularly are covered on the individual insurance market, their coverage will get worse. So they'll be exposed to more out-of-pocket cost for their health care.
CBO estimates 24 million patients that either are on insurance now or would be on insurance by the time we get 10 years down the road will not have insurance.
That's correct. So a total of 56 million lives that'll be uninsured by 2026, whereas under the current law, it would have been 28 million. My takeaway is that it's bad for pharma. So there's missing customers. There's folks that aren't getting care because they're uninsured. There are of the folks that are getting care, they either are uninsured and they are going to need definite help if they're going to fill their prescriptions and take their drugs, or they may need free drug in a lot of cases. I think something we haven't mentioned yet is that a big chunk of those uninsured lives will come from the Medicaid sector that can't afford to pay out of pocket for very much, if anything. So I think in the short term, there's an 14 million that are expected to be lost in the insurance market by 2018 due specifically to the loss of the individual mandate and to higher premiums in that time frame.
Obviously, every patient matters, but some of the patients will have more of a financial impact on pharma companies. Which of these patients does have more of a financial impact on pharma companies?
I think that the answer to that is highly contingent. So it depends on what company you are and what kind of products you make and the cost of those products and the competition in your market. If you're a cancer drug manufacturer, you might already be giving a lot of free drug away to Medicaid patients who enroll in your charitable program. Whether or not these Medicaid patients roll off insurance might not impact you so much. If you're, you know, more of a primary care drug manufacturer, it might have a different impact on your bottom line.
So, Nicole, one of the ways that I think about it is not purely from the fact that we're losing patients, but also we're losing real dollars that we can just look at and see what is coming out of the system, some of which will go to pharma, some of which will go to the rest of the healthcare system. And if we look at where the revenues come from the Affordable Care Act, it's really from two taxes on the wealthy. One is a 0.9% tax on marginal income above $250,000 for joint filers. And then there's another one that is a 3.8% tax on investment income. And altogether, those taxes and a couple of other taxes, just if I'm reading the CBO report, would reduce revenues by $592 billion over the 2017 to 2026 period as a result of the provisions. So this is money that is coming into the system currently, or would come into the system over the next 10 years, that will not come into the system and be spent on healthcare. So if we think of it that way, we can see what the effect is likely for pharma. So we have $592 billion. If we look at what pharma gets of healthcare in general in the U.S., it's about 10% of the overall spend. So just simple math would suggest that our industry is set to lose about $59 billion over the next 10 years.
Pretty substantial.
It is pretty substantial. Is there anything that you saw in this that as you looked at the at Trump Care as being something that you thought would be a positive, anything at all to be a positive for pharma companies?
I don't have any positive really for pharma out of this. Did you see any?
So one of the taxes that gets repealed is a repeal on the tax on prescription medications. And that's running at $2.7 billion a year. It's a little bit different in some years. For example, 2018, it's $3.1 billion. But altogether, so we're talking about a $24.8 billion tax that's currently accrued across the entire industry. All those that have revenue, they pay into this tax altogether. And that will be going away. So there is at least one positive thing for the industry. I don't think it changes how we deal with day-to-day issues, but there is something to offset that loss of patients.
I'm seeing some significant downsides, and I'm concerned about the downside risk here. One of my big takeaways from this bill is that patients are going to be exposed to an increasingly higher and higher percentage of the cost of care. And you can see that in the actuarial values of the plans that they'll be able to purchase on the individual market.
So you just called out actuarial values. What is an actuarial value?
An actuarial value is effectively a measure of the percentage of healthcare costs that'll be covered for a standard person on a health plan.
Okay, and those are the old bronze, silver, gold, platinum levels, right?
Right. So if you think about the legacy plans on the individual exchange market, they ranged from bronze up to platinum. At the bronze level, you had a 60% actuarial value. You had a lower premium, but you would have a lower percentage of your healthcare costs covered should you need healthcare attention. And then at the platinum level, it would have a 90% actuarial value.
Okay. So if you're on bronze, you should expect to pay not quite half of what your expenses are, but you'll get some of it, you'll get about 60% paid. And that's changing under the American Healthcare Act?
That's right. So at least the level that they're permitted to go to is changing under this Healthcare Act. So they're permitted to go below 60%. A health insurance company offering plans on the individual market would be permitted to go below 60%, though those plans would still be required to cover 10 essential categories, and there's a total out-of-pocket maximum that would remain the same. So this, in the CBO analysis, they said they believe that it'd be difficult to lower the actuarial value to 60% or lower. But in theory, insurers would be permitted to do that.
You said essential services. What are essential services?
So this includes things like ambulatory payments, mental health services and addiction treatment, maternity care, emergency services, lab services, pediatric services. So there's a list of them.
So these are things that the insurance companies are required to cover.
That's right. Consider kind of the baseline and that qualified plans must offer those essential services.
And still, even under the American Healthcare Act, most plans will be required still to give all of these services.
That's right.
In this case, the essential services are mostly covered for most plans, most normal plans, but for a specific Medicaid population, the ones that were under expanded under the Affordable Care Act, that group no longer has the same sets of essential services. Specifically, the addiction treatment and mental health are removed.
It's hard to know what to say about that other than that it's a real bummer.
Yes, it is a bummer. That's putting it mildly, I think. And if we even go away from the Medicaid plans and now look at the normal commercial insurance with high deductibles and high copays, that's also a problem. For patients that are on normal insurance, they get a copay card. If they get that in January, they may have all of their deductible left to pay. And so if the copay card is designed to be pay no more than, say, $10, and the drug costs, if we were putting something out there, say, $600, then $590 is paid now to pay off that patient's deductible if they're on a high deductible plan. And if we go to this more under insurance that you're suggesting will happen because of the AHCA, that we would then be looking at copay cards as being something that was at best very, very unprofitable and sometimes could be even negative profitability. We could be underwater in some cases in drugs where we already are paying a rebate to the payer.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this is going to vary by the drug and the duration of therapy and that kind of thing. There will be a seasonality, but amongst those seasons and those various types of drugs, is the early part of the year will be highly unprofitable.
Nicole, is there anything else that you saw within the AHCA that struck you as something that you would think would be very important or one of the most important things for a pharma company to know about and to prepare for?
Number one being the thing that we've been talking about so far, which is that increasing patient exposure to the cost of care. So higher premiums, higher deductibles, higher out-of-pocket, patients are going to feel the crunch on that. That's going to increase the pressure on pharma companies to provide some of the patient assistance services that we've discussed, like the charitable free drug programs, like copay cards, like giving money to third-party foundations, et cetera. And, you know, and a lot of pharma companies do give quite generously in those areas. However, they don't really get any attention or credit for it. And that's going to get worse, in my opinion. And the reason why is because as you have these patients with an increased exposure to the cost of care, sound bites to explain that to people are difficult. But an easy sound bite is blame the high pharma prices. In my mind, that's an easy sound bite. A much easier soundbite than deal with the inefficiencies in healthcare delivery. Nobody can get the latter. Like, that's a really complicated problem, even for those of us who work in healthcare. But looking at a drug and the price tag of that drug and talking about bringing down that price tag, that's an easy soundbite. That's something people can easily bite onto and take hold of and think that it's going to make a difference. Unfortunately, as you said earlier, drugs are only a small proportion of the overall cost of care, and it likely won't make the difference that folks are hoping for when it comes to what they're experiencing in out-of-pocket burden. But nonetheless, pharma companies are going to feel the heat, and the heat's going to probably get worse. I have worked on the research side of all of this, and I have worked on the business side of all of this. I know how exceedingly hard it is to do research down to the basic science level, and then you think about how that translates into the hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent on clinical trials every year and the extreme challenge that it is to bring a drug to market. I think there's a perception that a pill is a pill and it couldn't cost more than a dollar to produce, so why should I have to pay more than a dollar 50 for it? I think my point is that our government is writing bills, writing legislation to deal with the public perception around the cost of drugs. We are talking about doing things like making it easier to get drugs to market in the FDA, like allowing the government to negotiate for the price of drugs on Medicare, et cetera. And that's all dealing with the public perception. One of the biggest problems that I see is that we're not dealing with that the public perception is based on just a complete misunderstanding of what is costing us in healthcare, where are the big cost drivers, and why do we pay the amount that we do for pharmaceuticals, and what are you paying for when you pay that price tag? You aren't actually just paying for the drug that you're being given, but are in fact paying for all of the research and development that's happening and what it takes to bring that drug to market.
That's a perfect place then to introduce Meg Alexander to the show.
Thank you, Jeff Stewart. So I'm Meg Alexander. I lead the reputation and risk management practice at Inventive Health Communications. And in essence, what my practice and my colleagues and I do is we try to help primarily life sciences companies navigate some of the more challenging and dynamic communications challenges facing the industry right now. So everything from the affordability and the price of medicines to access challenges to evolving things like value frameworks and reviews. We really sit at the intersection of helping advise life sciences companies on these very dynamic matters.
One of those matters is the American Healthcare Act. How does it impact pharma?
I think the challenge with the American Healthcare Act, and something that the biopharmaceutical industry is extremely cognizant of, is the fact that it doesn't necessarily address the affordability and the price of medicines. And that's something that our life sciences clients are happy about. But by virtue of not addressing it, we're seeing other members of Congress trying to come up with their own bills and their own policies to address this head on. And, you know, we have seen over the course of the last year, there is a lot of populist sentiment surrounding the affordability of medicines. 7 out of 10 Americans, if you observe the polling today, will say that the cost of medicines are too high. And in fact, you know, they're blaming our clients for this in many cases. There's polling data that shows that they attribute the cost of medicines to pharmaceutical companies. So this is because of the fact that it is not addressed in the American Health Care Act. That debate very much continues to wage on, to the extent that we saw President Trump meet with an unusual partner, Congressman Elijah Cummings from Maryland, just last week. And supposedly they spoke on the phone 3 times discussing the affordability of medicines and considering proposals. So what's not actually in the AHCA is continuing to be debated and I think will continue to cause real problems for our life sciences clients. Ultimately, what this means for them as they look at the world around them and also as they look at the provisions in the AHCA is that there's going to be continued sensitivities about not only the cost of medicines, but the cost of care. As the AHCA moves forward and we look at a world where Medicaid block grants, for example, may be very high, where we see the negotiation of healthcare plans across state lines, we can expect that patients will be potentially seeing more of the cost of care and potentially less generous health insurance plans in the future for certain segments of society. So this puts our clients in a very challenging situation because they will not only continue to want to have their medicines well covered, but Americans will be feeling the cost in their pocketbook. So knowing that, they really need to work harder than ever before to better define and communicate the value that their medicines bring to bear and that their companies bring to bear, better define the value that your medicine brings beyond the value proposition that you're communicating with payers. You need to make everyday Americans understand the deep value that we're bringing. And value can be beyond the drug, by the way. Value can also be continued education with physicians. It can be registries that help us learn more about a disease state. There's many, many ways that life sciences companies bring tremendous value into our country and to patients and to many stakeholders, but we're going to have to work harder than ever to convey it.
Talking earlier to Nicole Hamilton, earlier on the show, we discussed how patient assistance programs will become more and more necessary, essentially, and likely will have to become richer because of things like higher deductibles or less generous programs in general. What's your feeling on patient assistance and how that is or may not be of value in blunting perhaps anger at prices?
It's a great question, and I think you and Nicole are exactly right, Jeff. I think as we see a future where we may have Medicaid block grants, which will mean that it becomes harder for states to cover as generously certain patients, where we see Medicaid expansion cease, there will be increasingly a need to help those patients who are uninsured and patients who are underinsured. And part of the challenge with this is that not only will our clients need to increase the amount of their charitable care, but they also need to be very cognizant with which how they do it. There's senators such as Senator Elizabeth Warren who are very scrutinous about patient assistance programs. In fact, she said in hearings last year in front of major pharmaceutical CEOs that she finds this to be an area or a strategy, I should say, that masks, quote unquote, the high cost of prescription drugs to the system. So, unfortunately for life sciences companies, we're in a really interesting conflict in the sense that the future is going to mean we will need charitable care and assistance more than ever because patients will certainly be feeling the cost of care and the cost of medicines in their purse and in their wallets. But at the same time, the level of scrutiny about the compliance around these programs will also be paramount. So we actually give our clients a fair number of recommendations about what they should be considering as they look to scale up their charitable care and their assistance in the future. And we've actually published on it before too, but some good best practices will involve doing things like publicly listing donations that you're giving to charitable organizations, ensuring, especially if you're an orphan drug or a rare drug developer, diversifying giving across several organizations. There's been a lot of scrutiny in the last year or two where it seems like a pharmaceutical company may be just setting up a fund with one charitable organization to help offset the cost of their medicines for government-insured patients. And there's been a lot of scrutiny about the actual charities themselves. So vetting the charitable partners that an organization works with is very important. And increasingly helping educate the public about patient assistance programs. I think my biggest complaint sometimes about working in the industry is that we speak in jargon that's very familiar to us, but not necessarily to the average American. And, you know, in a world where there's some Americans who didn't know that the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare were one and the same, we really need to make sure that we're doing a good job translating the really important services and assistance that we have for patients out there in ways that people not only can find it simply, but can understand it and take advantage of it.
And you make a good point, and especially if we're putting the patient assistance programs in place after there's a pricing concern raised, it seems like that might be a little too late.
Yes. I appreciate that message, Jeff, because that is probably one of my rallying cries. I feel very strongly that life sciences, biopharmaceutical companies provide tremendous programs, amazing, miraculous medicines increasingly, and fabulous programs to try to help patients who really need these medicines get access to them. But a guaranteed formula for failure, I should say, is by announcing a big commitment or some sweeping altruistic effort after a company has begun to face scrutiny. Part of the work that I do is very much focused on communications, and there's very good case studies of some very prominent headlines out there where a pharmaceutical executive announced a huge access commitment after they had shown up in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal as being accused of being a bad actor because of the price of their medicines. And it's very clear, if you wait as a pharmaceutical CEO to announce a goodwill commitment until after you've faced scrutiny, you will not receive the benefits of that goodwill. So for any drug developers out there, if you're entering a hot category where there's a lot of visibility or you're about to launch a very important new medicine, if you think you would ever consider making a bigger commitment or access program to the community that you seek to serve, do it at approval. Don't wait. Because today, pharmaceutical CEOs are getting asked about the price of their medicines within the first hour of the press release describing the approval going out the door. So the time intensity is very fast, and these are all considerations that executives should be thinking about on the runway to PDUFA.
Two provisions within the AHCA really leapt out at me as being potential problems for our industry, one of which is a benefit to our industry that does show up, and that is that we have a tax currently. It's about running about $2.7 billion a year, and so that tax would go away as it's repealed under this plan. Is that something that we're hearing and need to be managing as an industry?
I don't think it's made its way to the headlines yet. Frankly, if I were working for one of the trade associations that represents the industry, or if I was a CEO of a leading healthcare company, I think the challenge that is before us really continues to focus on drug pricing. And we've seen some CEOs make commitments about how much they will or will not increase the list prices of their medicines. So we see some pioneering leaders trying to step out ahead of the trade associations and address this. But my counsel would be that as an industry, we need to really take on the challenge of drug pricing. And that needs to be done not only on an industry-wide level, but on a company level. And the reason why I say this is beyond the fact that there are senators and members of Congress who still feel very strongly about drug pricing, and POTUS, our president of the United States, has campaigned on this and felt very concerned about the price of medicines, we should also expect to see state-based campaigns. Last year, we saw Proposition 61 in California that wanted to increase transparency around the price of medicines with the ultimate goal of helping bring down the price of medicines and matching it closer to what the Veterans Affairs administration pays. So some of these trends are not going away, and they probably pose the biggest continued threat to the industry at large. And their efforts that we say to our clients, in addition to working with your trade associations, you need to go out and you need to proactively address this for your company and your medicines, because if you're not doing it, who else will for you?
Meg, I said there were two things that leapt out at me as potential issues from the American Healthcare Act. And the second thing is this cap that exists on the expense reporting of salaries of insurance company executives. So there's a $500,000 cap above which insurance companies cannot count salaries as expenses. Under the AHCA, that cap is zeroed out, and any salary may be expensed. Question I have for you is, does that somehow come back on pharma companies? Are people making that mistake that this is nothing to do with, it really has nothing to do at all with pharma companies? It's insurance companies. But are we somehow getting in or in that firing line?
Jeff, I'm so glad you raised this, because even my husband and I, a week ago, waiting for the subway, he brought this up and said, well, you know, this is going to change the cap on pharmaceutical CEO executive pay. And I believe you're completely right. There's a lot of misinformation out there about this. Any company that has a major medicine that is coming to the market soon, or a new drug that's coming down the pipeline that there's a lot of anticipation for, pharmaceutical executives should be also considering their own compensation and salary packages, because in many cases that is in the public domain. And how you price a medicine and what your executives are paid is something that will be looked at by business reporters, and it will come to light. So even though this provision has nothing to do with pharmaceutical industry executives, it is very much being associated with them wrongly. So the industry should be working to clarify that. But beyond that point, it doesn't necessarily inoculate us from the same type of scrutiny that can occur, and it has occurred with some executives in the industry. These are sensitivities that we should be thinking about, and any good pharmaceutical CEO should have a good head of IR and a good head of public affairs sitting alongside them to help them think through how the public may interpret the value of their medicines and what that looks like relative to executive compensation.
Meg, Nicole, thank you both very much for being on the Inventive Health Podcast.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Jeff. We always love speaking with you.
The Inventive Health Podcast was brought to you by Inventive Health. If you have questions or comments or suggested topics for future shows, you may email us at podcast@inventivehealth.com. Thanks for listening.
What do I think? My takeaway is that it's bad for pharma.